Simon's lunch was delicious. Cream of broccoli soup, a Spanish omelet, apple pie. Dina liked eating Simon's cooking, and they hugged before sitting at the dinette table. I resented their closeness in a flash of remembered annoyance. While I still lived at home in Manhattan, I used to come back to find them talking and laughing in Dina's room, finishing each other's sentences happy as lovers. When they'd invite me to sit down and enjoy a record album, I felt patronized, excluded, more like a little brother than the eldest. "So eat," Simon urged now, trying to be funny, imitating our father. Nothing had changed. Simon used his fingers as a knife to push his food around, and Dina cut her food into smaller and smaller portions as if trying to make it disappear. We ate without speaking. I thought of my mother's favorite print, a Diego Rivera painting of a man bent almost to the ground under the weight of an impossibly heavy basket on his back. I felt that same heaviness sinking deeper and deeper inside of me, implacable. I wondered about this print. Would Simon or Dina want it? Did I? What would it remind me of? We sat like huddled survivors of a flood, thankful for the Red Cross bowl of soup. But that was nothing new. Our mealtimes, even family car trips to the Cloisters, to Hyde Park, Montauk Point, had often seemed provisional, a gathering of threatened strangers who knew that each other's company was no guarantee of safety. Was it our mother's past, the gaping emptiness in the center of our home that was like a meteor crater, one so vast that we could never even make a transit of its perimeter? "When I heard Mom was dead, I cried until I was sick," Dina broke out. "But it didn't change anything. I didn't feel better, just exhausted." Simon nodded. Dina's words plunged me back into a strange memory. I saw myself at 3 or 4, hysterical, sobbing hopelessly in the hallway outside a gleaming black apartment door, knowing I would not be let in until my mother was ready, or never. She had wildly plucked me from my chair in the kitchen and thrust me into the hall, slamming the black door as heavy as stone. What had I done or said? I couldn't remember. "What about you?" Dina asked, startling me. "You haven't been crying, have you?" I shrugged, saying I hadn't felt anything much. "Figures," Dina snapped, spearing some egg with her fork. "What's that mean?" "You're upset," Simon murmured, clearing his place. Dina stared at me, even prettier with her face flushed and tight. What was I supposed to do? Yell at her? Tell her she was wrong? Shake her? I left the table, grabbed my coat, and went for a walk. Though it's nothing like Ann Arbor, Forest Hills is mildly pleasant for a New York neighborhood, with street after street of red brick apartment buildings of all sizes, everywhere scraps of lawn, bushes, well-pruned trees. It's also careful, clean, and well-tended that Queens Boulevard's 8 lanes slash through like a gross and dangerous joke. We were actually not that far from the Queens neighborhood where Kitty Genovese had been killed in the early 1960s, and no one had come to her aid, even though the nightmare, the screaming and stabbing, went on for hours. To me, this symbolized New York every bit as much as the Statue of Liberty. General Braddock's plunge into the American wilderness began on May 29, 1755. The first obstacle nearly brought it to a halt. Braddock had ordered Sir John St. Clair to open and prepare a road over the Allegheny Mountains towards the Great Meadow. From the assembled British redcoats and colonial troops that had massed at Fort Cumberland, St. Clair had chosen 650 men. At dawn that morning, they marched to the forest edge and started to chop a road through the wilderness toward Fort Duquesne, some 125 miles away. Just to the west of Fort Cumberland rose a steep, forested ridge 1,400 feet high known as Haystack Mountain. A path of sorts existed over the crest. The road builders followed it, widening it as they went, accompanied by 50 wagons, Ben Franklin's efforts finally having delivered an additional 150 wagons. With their teams of horses straining in taut harnesses up the steep slopes, some of the 50 crested the top, but the precipitous descent nearly destroyed them, as wagons broke loose and bounced and crashed down among the trees and rocks. The ascent and descent were almost a perpendicular rock. 3 wagons were entirely destroyed, which were replaced from the camp, and many more were extremely shattered, recorded Washington's fellow aide-de-camp, Captain Orme. General Braddock, on horseback, inspected the route over this first obstacle and ordered more might and manpower thrown at it, as if sheer will and discipline alone could subjugate the American wilds. It was then that a young British naval officer named Spendalow had a different idea. Commanding the detachment of 30 sailors from the Royal Navy, Lieutenant Spendalow also showed a talent for reading terrain. He noticed a deep valley or gap just to the north of Haystack Mountain. Exploring it, he found that it cut right through the Great Ridge and had inexplicably escaped the attention of St. Clair and others laying out the road. The general immediately ordered a detachment of 100 men and an engineer to cut a new road through the gap. After 2 days of hard work, they had a passable route around Haystack Mountain. While troops cleared the road, young Washington wrote a packet of final letters before stepping into the wilds. To his mother, he wrote a brief, almost curt letter, dutiful but not affectionate, apologizing that he could not provide a Dutch manservant or the butter she had requested. She undoubtedly thought that, as he was near Pennsylvania, where the Dutch, actually German, farmers lived in numbers, these two items would be readily available. He also apologized for not visiting her on his recent journey back to Williamsburg for the general's cash. All in all, it read like the letter of a son trying to avoid a demanding mother. He wrote to Sally Fairfax in far more affectionate terms and with the convoluted syntax he associated with polite society, noting that she had asked to be informed of his safe arrival at Fort Cumberland. He pointed out that she had requested that he communicate this in a letter to some mutual acquaintance. He had not heard a word from her. Did this mean she did not want to correspond with him, or were his fears about her silence unfounded? He wanted reassurance. "How easy it is to remove my suspicions, enliven my spirits, and make me happier than the day is long, by honoring me with a correspondence which you did once partly promise." About to enter the wilderness and face an unknown fate, he could not let go of his thoughts and feelings for Sally and a half-promise she had supposedly made. Horace and Marcia were married early in February. The sensation in academic circles, both at Yale and Princeton, was tremendous. Horace Tarbaugh, who at 14 had been played up in the Sunday magazine sections of metropolitan newspapers, was throwing over his career, his chance of being a world authority on American philosophy, by marrying a chorus girl. They made Marcia a chorus girl. But like all modern stories, it was a 4.5-day wonder. They took a flat in Harlem. After 2 weeks' search, during which his idea of the value of academic knowledge faded unmercifully, Horace took a position as clerk with a South American export company. Someone had told him that exporting was the coming thing. Marcia was to stay in her show for a few months, anyway until he got on his feet. He was getting $125 to start with, and though of course they told him it was only a question of months until he would be earning double that, Marcia refused even to consider giving up the $150 a week that she was getting at the time. "We'll call ourselves Head and Shoulders, dear," she said softly, "and the shoulders will have to keep shaking a little longer until the old head gets started." "I hate it," he objected gloomily. "Well," she replied emphatically, "your salary wouldn't keep us in a tenement. Don't think I want to be public. I don't. I want to be yours. But I'd be a half-wit to sit in one room and count the sunflowers on the wallpaper while I waited for you. When you pull down $300 a month, I'll quit." And as much as it hurt his pride, Horace had to admit that hers was the wiser course. March mellowed into April. May read a gorgeous riot act to the parks and waters of Manhattan, and they were very happy. Horace, who had no habits whatsoever, he had never had time to form any, proved the most adaptable of husbands, and as Marcia entirely lacked opinions on the subjects that engrossed him, there were very few joltings and bumpings. Their minds moved in different spheres. Marcia acted as a practical factotum, and Horace lived either in his old world of abstract ideas or in a sort of triumphantly earthy worship and adoration of his wife. She was a continual source of astonishment to him. The freshness and originality of her mind, her dynamic, clear-headed energy, and her unfailing good humor. And Marcia's co-workers in the 9 o'clock show, whither she had transferred her talents, were impressed with her tremendous pride in her husband's mental powers. Horace, they knew, only as the very slim, tight-lipped, and immature-looking young man who waited every night to take her home. "Horace," said Marcia one evening when she met him as usual at 11, "you look like a ghost standing there against the streetlights. You losing weight?" He shook his head vaguely. "I don't know. They raised me to $135 today, and I don't care," said Marcia severely. You're killing yourself working at night. You read those big books on economy. Economics, corrected Horace. Well, you read them every night long after I'm asleep, and you're getting all stooped over like you were before we were married. But Marcia, I've got to... No, you haven't, dear. I guess I'm running the shop for the present, and I won't let my fella ruin his health and eyes. You've got to get some exercise. I do. Every morning, I know, but those dumbbells of yours wouldn't give a consumptive 2 degrees of fever. I mean real exercise. You've got to join a gymnasium. Remember you told me you were such a trick gymnast once that they tried to get you out for the team in college, and they couldn't because you had a standing date with Herb Spencer? I used to enjoy it, mused Horace, but it would take up too much time right now. One of the biggest ongoing changes in amateur radio is the growing use of digital voice modes. There are now several different digital voice techniques for voice communication. Each turns the voice's audio into a stream of digital data using a codec, integrated circuit, or software. The digitized voice is then packaged with additional data used to control the way the signal is exchanged with and processed by another station. The bundle of data is then fed to the transmitter, where it is added to the actual over-the-air signal. This process is reversed at the receiving station so that the digitized voice is turned back into analog speech. FCC rules make no distinction between analog voice and digital voice signals, so they must use the same band segments and meet the same specifications for signal bandwidth and quality. Some of the digital voice protocols can also exchange graphic images similar in quality and speed to slow scan television, SSTV. When exchanging images, the FCC rules for image signals apply. I cover operating with these digital voice modes in Chapter 9. AOR's digital voice and FreeDV are the most common digital voice signals found on HF as of mid-2020. If you tune them in with a radio setup for analog SSB, you'll hear a roaring noise. If you are tuning by using a spectrum display as discussed earlier that shows signal strengths across a band, digital voice signals appear solid in that they tend to occupy all of a channel without the peaks that follow speech patterns. The decoding equipment or software for these modes has tuning indicators to help you adjust the frequency for proper reception. When you're tuned in, the codec will sync up with the data and a voice will suddenly be heard. Several digital voice systems are in use on the VHF and UHF bands, with many repeaters for each system. They operate on the same channels that analog FM repeaters use. The most common as of mid-2020 are D-Star, System Fusion, and DMR. Listening to these systems requires a radio designed to receive that type of signal. The RepeaterBook website makes it easy to search for repeaters of each type in your area. Another option for listening in is to access the repeater system through the internet and stream the audio to your computer speakers. Each system has a different method for accessing the audio and may require you to register before you can do so. A mentor who is familiar with the ins and outs of a particular digital mode is very helpful here. Tip: some digital system repeaters can relay both analog and digital voice signals. Typically, a repeater's users tend to be all analog or all digital, but some systems support both types. One problem with all these digital systems is that they are not compatible with each other. Systems using AOR modems and FreeDV software can't talk to each other. The same is true for D-Star, System Fusion, and DMR systems. The currently preferred solution is a hotspot, a small radio that understands one or more of the digital voice systems. A typical hotspot is shown in Figure 8-8, along with its web interface app and a pair of digital voice radios. Your radio communicates with the hotspot as if it were a separate station. The hotspot relays the digitized voice signals over the internet to a digital voice network, even one that uses a different system. This is a convenient way to use a single radio with several different digital voice systems. For 2 weeks and more, the Army was on the move, its long, irregular columns winding through the untroubled countryside of Lower Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, where open fields and low-lying wooded hills were only now showing the first faint signs of spring. In scores of market towns and crossroad hamlets, the local citizenry came out to cheer and offer food and drink, or just to stand at gatepost and kitchen doorways, taking in the spectacle of so many of their countrymen armed and on the march, whole regiments passing for hours at a time. large armies of any kind, were an unfamiliar sight to Americans. No army of such size as this had ever been seen anywhere in the colonies. And the army was stepping along with great expedition, as General Heath wrote, with high-ranking uniformed officers like Heath on horseback, stragglers and trains of heavy baggage wagons struggling to keep up. Hurry was the order of the day, every day. He must hasten his march to New York, Nathaniel Greene had been instructed by Washington. Henry Knox and his artillery were to move as speedily as possible by the directest road thither. Several times, Washington referred to his own extreme hurry. On April 5, the day the commander paraded into Providence, it seemed all Rhode Island had come to catch sight of him. Two of Greene's regiments served as escort. None were to turn out, except those dressed in uniforms, all washed, both face and hands clean, their beards shaved, and hair combed and powdered. At an elegant banquet provided by the gentlemen of the town at Hacker's Hall, Washington was feted and toasted befitting a national hero. But at first light the next day, he was on his way again with no time to spare. John Greenwood, the fifer, would remember everyone moving at great speed. A 5 or 6 mile march before breakfast was usual, 15 to 20 miles a day about average, however seasonably wet and unpredictable the weather or miserable the roads, which, with the frost still coming out of the ground, could be slick with mud even on fair days. On days of wet weather and very bad traveling, recorded a soldier named Solomon Nash marching with a Massachusetts artillery company, they made only 10 to 14 miles while moving 10 brass field pieces. Marching did not trouble him anything like he had expected, Lieutenant Joseph Hodgkins wrote to his Sarah after a few days on the road. I am willing to serve my country in the best way and manner that I am capable of, and as our enemy are gone from us, I expect I must follow them. I would not be understood that I should choose to march, but as I am engaged in this glorious cause, I am willing to go where I am called. He had vowed to march with cheerfulness, and plainly the spirits of the whole army were greatly improved by being on the move and by the warm reception along the way. I am a good deal tired of marching, he confessed after crossing into Connecticut, though we get very good entertainment in general. People are very kind to us. Like the majority of Massachusetts men, Hodgkins had never been so far from home.